it is time to get started, and my name's Tom Tobin. I'm from Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago, and today we're going to be talking about risk conversations, how to become a change shepherd on your campus. We usually talk about change agents, but I'd like you to take your brains into a slightly different space. And some of you who were here earlier know that to talk about risk and those kinds of conversations, I'm going to ask you to think 3,000 years ago. Deep Purple, Perfect Strangers actually has nothing to do with ancient Egypt, but they're using the tritone chord, which is the basis of a lot of Egyptian and Middle Eastern music. So there is a little tiny connection in there, although Walk Like an Egyptian will be the next one, because I use the Egyptian motif over and over again, so thank you, Gary. But for now, think for a moment about this scenario, if you will. I'm such a Luddite, I don't even have a mouse. This is a thought exercise. Those of you who've seen the Ten Commandments will recognize our actors here. Edwin G. Robinson, Yul Brynner. And Pharaoh has chosen you to build a fitting monument to his glory. So think for a moment about what kinds of risks are associated with starting up such a project, keeping it going, and then presenting it to Pharaoh. How could things go wrong? How could things go differently? So as we think through this, oh, by the way, this is the don't make Yul Brynner mad clause of things, we'll stop back in and check in with Pharaoh as we go along here. But take a couple of moments and just think. You don't have to build a pyramid, by the way. The one thing that I didn't ask you, I asked you who you are and where you are, but not what do you do. So if I could, let's take a couple of seconds and just pull the room. And if we're all in the same job, that's great. But if we're not, let's customize a little bit toward the jobs that we do. And if you could go around the room and just tell me, introduce yourself to everybody else, and let us know what you do.
That's something you're trying to get.
Go ahead.
Thanks.
I'm Bob Lane. I'm a professor. I'm a professor in political science at Sacramento Valley State University. I've been there 23 years. I'm a pre-law advisor on campus and done a variety of service, including the last 4 years I was a unionized faculty, and so I was union president the last 4 years. And we're just starting. We're in the initial stages of a learning, teaching, faculty development center. I'm one of two full-time faculty that have been asked by the provost to help get this off the ground. We have two full-time, wonderful administrative people that are doing it well.
So early stages for you folks.
Very early stages. We're here to get educated.
Fantastic.
Definitely. I'm Gary Smith from the University of New Mexico. As a faculty development office for personality. I'm a professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences. I did direct our main campus teaching and learning center for 7 years, and for the last 3 months I've been over starting a new faculty development program in our medical school.
I'm Fran Glazer. I'm the director of the Center for Teaching and Learning at the New York Institute of Technology. In addition to that, I do a lot of work. I'm also an assistant provost, so I do a lot of work with the curriculum process and institutional initiatives. I'm Lisa Kurz. I'm from Indiana University Bloomington. I'm an assistant director of our Teaching and Learning Center. And I'm here partly because I'm involved in some initiatives on my campus that involve change for faculty. We are starting a program assessment process, leading some departments on our campus through the process of assessing their curricula. And so I'm interested in conversations about change.
Fantastic.
Doug Holton, Associate Director, Center for Teaching and Learning at Amarillo. We have several initiatives every year lined up. Like last year, there was iPad initiative, hybrid initiative, now we have online initiative, second year engineering course initiative. And I was just really interested in forgetting her name, the lady's talk earlier, and to hear your perspective on change management too. I need to read up more on this area.
I'm Stan Guppy. I'm an evolutionary biologist, conservation biologist, philosopher. My academic appointment is PEB, College of Evolutionary Biology. I'm now at three quarters done with the Teaching and Learning Center, and I have my hands full with many, many, many things. And we view as our mission as being agents, shepherds, guides of change for the university.
Sounds like you wear a whole bunch of different hats, too.
I'm Sharon Hendricks, University of West Georgia. We just opened our center 8 days ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. We don't have a mission or a vision or anything yet, but there's a commitment that we will be part of the institutional change going forward, so I'm here to learn how to do that.
Introduce yourself.
Sure. This is Jan Kienschliff. I'm in the University Library at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign.
Good to have you here. And so it sounds like we have a number of people who are wearing one hat. And you're going, no, because you're not in that group. There will be more groups. We have a number of people who are wearing one hat. We have a particular mission. We're trying to ramp up a center or work on a particular project. And we have a number of people also who wear multiple hats. This is where Frank goes, yes, that's me.
And I don't look that happy about it, though.
All right, and that too. But there are actually two different paths we can take through this thought experiment of going back to ancient Egypt. One of them is to be like Edwin G. Robinson, the character of Dathan in the Ten Commandments, who was the overseer. That's the guy with one hat. Middle management, all I do is I make sure that Charlton Heston makes bricks. And that's pretty much his task. The other way to go through it is to have multiple hats, to be somebody like Pharaoh's advisor, who is overseeing the workforce, overseeing the design, overseeing the temple, the templates, all those kinds of things. So select in your own head how many hats you're going to be wearing. And
Tom?
Yes?
You make Pharaoh's advisor sound like he has a lot more influence than I feel like I have. I need another role to...
Well, if you'd like, you could also be a scribe. Those are the folks who actually know how to read and write in hieroglyphics, but are not necessarily the be-all, end-all decision makers. But without them, the whole system doesn't function.
You don't want to be a scribe.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a slave before you get to Egypt.
I have an appointment in my position next week so that I can get a doctor's notice excusing me from paperwork. I'm hoping this will work.
I'm going to move past. This was the Geico commercial. Where did you know that the ancient Egyptian pyramids were a mistake?
Oh, yes.
And the overseer unfurls the scroll that shows the great three cubes and then lowers it to see the pyramids rising up out of the sand, he says. So let's talk about what risk is and talk about one of the assumptions and underlying rhetorics that inform our conversation today. And that is that I'm going to be talking from a perspective of the formal practice of project management. And so I have my project management professional certification and was a project manager in industry. I worked for Blue Cross and Blue Shield in Illinois for 7 years before I came back into academics. And I'm finding that a lot of the wording, concepts, and practices of formal project management really have helped me to be able to have more challenging conversations with folks at the dean level, at the provost level, and at the level of the president's office, the board of directors, those kinds of folks. So let's talk at the very, very bare bones basics about what is risk. It's any uncertain event, anything where we can't tell what's going to happen. And issues are factors that we know in advance. We know that we need funding. We know that we need to get approval for IRB if we're using human subjects. So those are not necessarily risks. So there's a difference between risks and issues. Risks are uncertainties in the project. From 3,000 years ago, here is your plague of locusts. Is this an issue or is this a risk for your project for Pharaoh?
It's a risk.
Why do you say that?
Because you didn't know that the plague of locusts was going to happen until it happened.
Yep, that is an uncertainty. In other words, this is not something that you can necessarily plan for. And the plague of locusts would not be an issue because it's not part of your project. unless, you know, you want the locusts to come out the top of the monument or something. But in terms of the project that you're doing, yeah, the plague of locusts would be a risk. And how often does the plague of locusts come around? Those of you who've in the Judeo-Christian tradition, you may have a leg up on this. But how often is it?
7 years?
No, there were seven plagues.
Yeah, there were seven plagues. They only happened once. So the likelihood of that, the risk, is very small. And from formal project management, we can actually quantify the risks that we're talking about. And that's one of the things I'm going to ask you to do as you're talking about Pharaoh here. Here's the other thing. Oh, by the way, you can't have a presentation about ancient Egypt without seeing Dr. Zahi Hawass, cultural minister of antiquities in Egypt. He was, then he wasn't, then he was again, and now I think he's on trial, actually. So we have to keep our fingers crossed for Dr. Hawass. But risk can be positive or it can be negative. What are we talking about when we talk about negative risk? We all know what that is. Something bad is going to happen. And so, what are some of the negative risks of that project for Pharaoh? Those of you with multiple hats, maybe come up with one.
The slaves might leave.
They might leave.
Yeah. If the plagues are successful enough.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Right. They might split it. Okay.
And then you've lost your workforce.
Oh, okay. Labor issues.
Right.
You might not read what's in Pharaoh's head, so that you didn't know that he wanted cubes. You thought maybe he wanted pyramids.
By the way, the real outcome of that is you see a lot of mummified cats in tombs. They're coming to find out that that was a tradition that later generations of ancient Egyptians just did because it was tradition. They actually didn't really quite know why the cat worship, the whole Bastet thing, and they're finding out that earlier Egyptians, yeah, they had their reasons, but later Egyptians, it's just tradition.
We do a lot of that in higher education. A lot of things we don't know why we're doing.
Yeah.
Okay. What other kind of negative risks do we have? This is just for Pharaoh. This isn't for your institution. So here.
Mm-hmm. Good. I suppose you could not get it done soon enough, or you could not meet his deadlines.
That actually happened quite a lot in ancient Egypt. Pharaoh would die on a human time frame, and how long did it take to build some of the monuments and pyramids? Yeah, they had to put Pharaoh in a secret box inside a hillside until the great big monument was done several lifetimes later. So yeah, absolutely, time frame. But positive risk, there are two different kinds of risk. Risk can be negative, and you can quantify, typically, how negative is that risk. How negative is the risk of Pharaoh dying before the thing is completed? Well, he's not Pharaoh anymore, so you have pretty good autonomy after Pharaoh's gone. Unless the new Pharaoh says, no, I don't want his name anywhere, and we're going to strike his name from every hieroglyph everywhere, which actually did happen with him. But positive risk, taking a chance in order to achieve a benefit or savings. And we do this all the time in our academic world, but we don't usually think about it as a risk. So, for example, to move away from 3,000 years ago for just a second, if we delay the start of a particular project, maybe we could bring in a consultant who was otherwise busy who could help us speed things up. So that's a positive risk. And it's the English vernacular is take a chance. If we take a chance on moving a deadline or reassigning a resource, we could get something good in return. Back to 3,000 years ago, what are some of the positive risks we could take in our project for Pharaoh? By the way, Pharaoh has asked you to design a fitting monument to his glory.
Okay.
All right. Think, too, of some of the negative risks that have come up as well. We've identified labor issues, time, project time. How could we take some chances to make sure that some of those things might not happen?
You could cut corners on materials and construction to speed up the timeline.
For example?
Make it a little bit smaller.
Ooh. Yeah, then so your cubit is just a little shorter than everybody else's cubit. Okay.
Employ more people.
Employ more people. What does that mean 3,000 years ago?
Enslave the
war. Enslave more people. We need to go to war so we can get more labor force. Okay, that's excellent. What other positive risks could we take?
Kill Pharaoh so the timeline goes away.
Strong. strangely enough, 3,000 years ago, this one's a valid one. It actually did happen three times in throughout the ancient dynasties of the Upper Nile. Pharaoh was assassinated.
They invent new devices that are more efficient at getting the stones up there, however they got them up there.
So Leonardo, what kind of things are we doing?
Well, I mean, you know, like whatever mechanism they had for getting the stones up on the pyramid, if they took some time out to invent some better way of doing it, it might be risked up, it doesn't work.
Where do you find the ancient astronauts?
Strangely enough, usually in this session, if I'm anticipating an awful lot of people, I'll have a bowl at the entryway, and I'll say, take a slip out of the bowl. And some people will be stone cutters, some people will be overseers, and there are three slips of paper in there out of 50 that say UFO driver and various other, yeah, sort of conspiracy theory things. And people say, I'm a UFO driver? I'm a what? So, yeah, and thank you for bringing in that angle. So, you know, either invent new technologies or co-opt the technologies that the alien overlords give you.
I would experiment with using crushed locusts to lubricate the skids.
Well, that could be a new diet.
Yeah.
For the slaves.
Slaves.
I was going to say, you could get in this case, you could get a twofer. So, you know, boil up the skids and whatever falls off becomes feed for your labor force. Okay, you guys are getting the idea here. So, positive and negative risk. We've talked about some different examples there. This chart is from the Project Management Institute, and it is all of the different phases and elements of any project. And what we do is we take what most people do sort of intuitively, and we quantify each of those phases. So for example, when we're first starting up in the initiating phase, what elements do we do? Well, we put together a project charter. In other words, we say what we want to do in the project. The project has a defined beginning and end time. It's not just business as usual. You can tell when you're done. So with Pharaoh wanting a monument to his glory, well, yeah, you can tell when you're done because the building is finished. We also, when we're getting started, identify our stakeholders. Who are the people and human resources who are going to actually do the work? Who are the people who are going to oversee it, keep it on track, approve it, all those kinds of things. And you'll notice at each stage, there's planning up here. I apologize, the font's a little small if you're in the back. There's executing the work, monitoring and controlling to make sure things stay in scope, and closing out the project. And each of these columns, we can integrate content. We can make sure that things stay within scope, within the boundaries of what we want to do. Time, cost, quality, human resources, communications, risk, and procurement. So in formal project management, all of these things are quantified out. And I keep talking about the numbers. I keep talking about quantification. And we're going to get into that in a couple of minutes. But just in terms of the project management process, and yes, this PowerPoint is on Wikipedia. Two of the things that you want to be able to do are when you are planning out your project, plan your risk management process. In other words, what are the questions you're going to ask for positive and negative risk? And we've already heard we could kill Pharaoh, we could enslave some more folks from other neighboring countries. By the way, faculty developers love this thought exercise because these are not things we can do on our own campus. So, perform qualitative and quantitative risk analysis and plan your responses to the risks. So one of the things we started off with was that plague of locusts. Very small possibility that it will happen. So do we need a plan for what happens if we have a plague of locusts? Maybe yes, maybe no, we'll find out. And then as the work is actually going on, you have to dip back in every now and then to monitor and control for those risks. Halfway through the project, have the risks changed? Is Pharaoh suddenly looking fairly frail? Are your labor force eating more food than you anticipated? So, in terms of this risk column, you'll see that as you're planning things out, you do a lot more thinking about risk, and then you have to come back in the heat of things as the work is actually being done to monitor what's going on and re-ask some of those questions. So, let's go back to Pharaoh for a moment here. And this is a the OK People breaks over. This is actually a still from a break during D.W. Griffith's The Ten Commandments. And so you can see the actors are sort of lounging around. Nobody's actually pulling the giant blocks. And what would happen if things went other than as expected? But what that begs the question is, how do you expect things to go? So let's put on our project manager hats for Pharaoh, and how do we expect things to go? What's our ideal case for this monument? Now, I know that all of you want to be in charge of the project, but for the purposes of what we're doing today, let's all work together. What kind of a monument should we make for Pharaoh? Assuming we don't have Pharaoh here and can't read his mind, so he'll be okay with what we design. I'll make some pyramids, a statue.
Can we just plant a tree and put a plaque?
Yeah, you could.
So we could do something simple.
Fitting monument for a guy who's also a god. You know, what do you get a guy who's a god? He's got everything.
Right? A temple.
Oh, a temple. Okay, we have a suggestion for a temple. So how do you expect maybe building a temple to go? What would you need to do?
Kind of like building a pyramid. You need lost legs.
Okay, so you need a fairly large workforce. So ideally, you would collect a workforce.
You would need different kinds of workforce because you've got to get the stone from somewhere.
Specialization of labor.
You need some expertise.
Okay, so you need some general labor and you need some skilled labor.
Do you need some materials?
Materials, yeah. I'm sure you were talking about materials here.
You need the architect.
Mm-hmm. Oh, design. Yeah. Okay. So we need somebody to actually put it together sort of on paper.
Someone to tell people what to do, where to put the stones and where to.
You need some middle management.
Architect into.
Mm-hmm. How long do you think it'll take?
Just a couple of days, really.
Oh, I was here and back.
A family of temples. Yeah.
Okay. Let's assume that Pharaoh's in his late 20s, which most of them were by the time they became Pharaoh. And Pharaoh would like to have the monument within, say, 5 years, which is, by the way, completely unreasonable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. 90 years.
Yeah, that's actually about right. Depending on the size of the temple, if you're thinking about Karnak with the four giant statues on it, they say that took about 80, 85 years to produce. All right, so far so good. Here's the fun question. This is where we get into risk management at the very top level. We can get down into the weeds, and we will get down into the weeds, not the bulrushes, we'll find Moses. But at the very top level, all of those elements that we described, and a few like time, cost, how are we going to pay the people who need to get paid, how are we going to keep the people who aren't getting paid from running away, to Gary's point. At the very top level, how many of those pieces could you, and Fran said maybe we could cut some corners, how many of those pieces could you remove and still have a viable project? Now, I'm not talking about remove the labor force entirely. But how many people of your anticipated labor force, if you didn't get them, you could still build the temple? General laborers, is that number more flexible than stonemasons? So the first pass in terms of assessing risk is, the first pass in terms of assessing risk is to think about the project in terms of, here we go, how many parts you could remove before the objective is endangered. And this is called the minus one thinking strategy. And this is when you're still on the back of the envelope. You haven't really put together a charter for your project, but you have a vague idea of what you want to be able to do. And one of the things that helps is in project management, there is something called the critical path through your project. In other words, these elements or these actions must be taken or the rest of the project cannot continue. So let's think about time, scope, cost, and human resources for just a second for Pharaoh. So for Pharaoh, he wants it in 5 years. We have a suggestion from Stan that it might take up to 90. So in terms of our project plan, okay, we're going to plan it for 5 years, and we're going to, the technical term is called crash the project. We're going to throw way more resources at it. So what we could do in 90 years, with 50 stonemasons and 1,000 laborers. We could do in 10 years with 600 stonemasons and 10,000 laborers. So if we don't have the time, we need to increase the human capital. If we don't have the money, we need to increase the time. So
this is the good, fast, cheap, choose two.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the two-legged sawhorse of project management. Yeah. Okay. You're exactly right. Yeah.
Sorry, this is a little off topic. I was curious, do you guys ever use system modeling tools like Scala, or you know, like if you increase this, it'll decrease this? Or?
Absolutely. Faro doesn't have access to charts and system modeling. Yeah. And we don't for the purposes of our conversation today, but we do use it all the time in our institution. There are a number of pieces of software, including at a very bare bones level, Microsoft Project, that allows you to put in, here's this resource, it's going to be 40 hours a week for you, here's this resource, it's going to be 10 hours a week for you. And that allows you to get to that critical path. In other words, if we don't cut the stones, it doesn't matter whether we have 1,000 or 10,000 general laborers ready. We got to cut the stones first. So that's part of our critical path. That has to occur. That action has to take place. And that's where, how many elements could you remove before the project is in danger? So while you're cutting the stones, you don't need to be going out to war to get a general labor force of 10,000 people, because you won't have a use for them yet, and you'll have to feed them. That's a negative risk for your project. So bringing the resources in at the right time, if you know what's on your critical path, then you're better able to plan for when to bring things in and when to phase things out in terms of time, cost, human resources, and plan. So far, so good? You guys feeling like you're okay with Faro so far?
I'm okay with Faro, but I have to leave because I've got to catch my shuttle to the airport.
In which case, safe travel. Absolutely. Let's flip our brains around for a minute here. Let's imagine that the project is done and that it has failed. Here is Anubis making sure that there's nothing extra in the sarcophagus. If any of your internal organs make it with you to the afterlife, you're going to be put to work and you're not loyal to it. By the way, that's why you have those canopic jars with all the internal organs in them. You gotta take everything out because only the soul is supposed to move to the afterlife. And they have quality control in the afterlife. They will check. So, in terms of imagining what has happened if it's failed, the technical term for this is called a pre-mortem discussion. Let's have one. So, we built our project, but it didn't work. What are some of the reasons why it didn't work?
Faulty plan. Faulty architectural plan, for example.
Oh, okay, so it didn't actually stand up.
It collapses, yeah.
All right, cool. So that's one thing here. In fact, let's do our pre-mortem up here.
Is this how we're identifying the critical path for thinking of what could fail?
You're good.
Sorry, that's a quiet.
No. Listen, I'm perfectly happy to reveal everything ahead of time. What other things could have caused our project not to work properly?
There could have been food shortage, so then you have a labor shortage.
Food shortage? Oh yeah, plagues.
Faulty material. Substandard material.
Faulty materials? Let's get a few more up here.
Worker strike.
Slave strike, you just killed. Oh, that doesn't help.
No, it does not. Worker unrest, yeah.
As soon as you hit 5 years and one day, Pharaoh's going to tell you it failed.
Why is that?
Because it's not done in 5 years.
It didn't come out on time.
But the timeline was unrealistic to begin with, so
that's a whole life.
You know, I know that's why I'm asking the question. So if you look at it rationally, it's not failed. But if you look at it from
Farrah's
point of view.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that was bad. One of the risks.
We're getting on towards two more slides.
Okay.
You're awesome.
One of the risks would be that what Farrah had in mind could have been a moving target. This happens with defense spending and defense contracts oftentimes. They contract for this, and then as it's being built, they want these features, this, and this, and this, and this. And that may contribute to the failure.
Moving target. By the way, how many of you, when you've watched programs about Egypt, or if you had an opportunity to visit ancient Egypt, know about the temple of Karnasam? Nobody does, because it was never finished. They don't let tourists in. It is just a chamber hewn out of the rock, and the hieroglyphs go on one wall, and then they just stop. And there is a note in hieroglyphic characters from one of the builders that says, Pharaoh has changed his mind, and we are moving to another location. So yeah, design creep happens.
Oh my gosh.
What other things could have caused our project not to go as we expected, or not to be successful? Faulty architecture, there's a food shortage, plague issues, faulty materials, worker unrest, Pharaoh's timeline, we didn't need it. What else?
Natural disasters.
Act of God, that's the plague, right?
Yeah.
Subversion.
Plague to another act of God.
Yeah. I'm going to put disasters up with plagues if you don't mind.
Yeah, disease, I guess.
Oh, yeah, disease outbreak. Actually, I'm going to put that down here as a separate item, and I'll say why in a couple seconds here. Anything else cause Pharaoh's project not to stay on the rails, so to speak?
Subversion.
Worker unrest. Oh, no. Plotting. Somebody else has it in for your project, which is different from worker unrest. So let's take a look here. This is a wonderful way to do a pre-mortem. And this is something to do before you even start the project, because by identifying the ways in which the project has mentally failed in the future, what you are doing is you're setting yourself up to identify ways to mitigate these risks. Ways to, and Frank, you're absolutely right with your comment, that if, you know, it's faulty architecture, then one of the challenges or the gates that your architect has to go through is to build that scale model and put a loan on it. You know, have Moses stomp out a couple of bricks and put them on top of the scale model and see how it handles. By the way, Egypt in an earthquake zone? Do we know?
Well, that canal is a fault line, right?
The Nile, not.
Suez. I mean, that, I don't know.
Yep. So, okay, so we know something that we didn't know 3,000 years ago. So if we were building the pyramids today, we'd never put them where we put them, except the alien overlords told us to put them there. And so we have a number of possible deal breakers. These are things that would cause the entire project to go off the rails, so to speak, and doom the whole project. And these are the big ones. There are a few little sort of this could happen, then that could happen in a Rube Goldberg machine way, ways to kill the project, but we don't think of those off the tops of our heads. We just think of the big stuff, and that's what a pre-mortem does for us. As we're integrating our project, in terms of scope, time, cost, quality, resources, communication, or procurement of resources, any of those big areas, we can lose out on the project. Now we have this list, let's do something with the content from our pre-mortem. So we do this back of the envelope risk assessment. By the way, here's our canopic jars. How can you tell whether these are real ones or fake ones for the tourist trade? That answer will be revealed toward the end of our presentation. So do that risk assessment. Find out which tasks are critical and which ones are not by removing the tasks from the project and assessing the impact. So this is another one of those which one can you remove kinds of things. So if we have a great risk of faulty architecture, could we remove the architect or quality checking for the architect from the project and still be successful? No, that's critical. Food shortage. Is this something over which we have control? If there's a drought and we can't get any food in, maybe yes, maybe no. We do have some control. We can hedge our bets before the project begins by stockpiling reserves of food. Is this critical? More than the architecture? Maybe yes, maybe no. There are alternate ways here. And our gentleman in the back, I apologize, he didn't have a chance to introduce himself, said we could go to war. We could get more workers. Yeah, and you know, if there's no famine over in the next country, well, get in your chariots and let's go get some workers. So this one, maybe not.
Or
mission critical.
And something like food shortage, the worst case scenario is it's a setback. It'll slow down the progress, it will, but it doesn't necessarily kill it. The architecture thing, it's
a yes or a no.
Yeah.
Absolutely, and these are go, no go, these are setbacks. So yeah. Exactly right thinking here.
So are they grades to the critical path? Like yes, 10%, 20%, 30%?
Things that are on the critical path are 100% necessary. Okay. And you're actually anticipating where Fran is going. So this is awesome. Let me actually just keep moving here and see if I can catch up with you guys. So what's likely and not likely to happen? What are and aren't risks, and how would you respond when risks arise? So we're getting into what is and isn't likely to happen. Is it likely that we'll need to check the architecture? Yeah, probably. Is it likely that there's going to be a food shortage? We've had 30 years of solid rains. The crops have come in. We get our rice, and we are able to grow our crops. So we're not anticipating drought. We're also not anticipating locusts either, but I mean, you know, it happens every 1,000 years or so. Faulty materials. How often did that happen in ancient Egypt? How often did they cut corners when they're building houses for ordinary people, when they're building monuments, those kinds of things? How often did we get shoddy workmanship?
I think that's linked to plotting and subversion, isn't it?
Eventually, but just in general.
Great. Frequently, also a lot of tools probably wore out pretty quickly.
Yeah, so in terms of, let's say, faulty materials.
Or if you have like an uneven stone, you know, can crack or whatever.
Yeah.
It's the desert sands shift over time.
Okay, so let's think about what actually happened with the pyramids. You can take a piece of paper and try to put it between two stones in the pyramids, and you can't slide it through. They are that closely aligned. In fact, the alien overlords must have told us how to do this, because there is no ancient technology that we know of that would have allowed them to mill that stuff that finely. So, Gary, I think you might be right here. We might, the alien overlord theory is looking better and better.
I was really into Eric von Daniken 30 years ago.
Oh, there you go. So nice. So, but what you're talking about here in the back, too, are wear and tear on materials. Is that something unexpected? Is that a risk? That's something that's a known. That's an issue. Errors. If we're going to be chopping blocks that are 1 cubit by 1 cubit by 1 cubit wide, we can estimate how many of those are going to be faulty blocks. The guy hits it with the chisel and a piece comes off because there was a fault in the rock, or there was a human error and it doesn't meet the specifications. If you've got a factory line, which we don't in academia, but if you've got a factory line that's manufacturing the pills that I take for my thyroid, they test those pills and they expect that 1 out of every 1,000 or 2 out of every 1,000 isn't going to be within specifications, and they chuck it to the side. That's an acceptable, planable issue. But in terms of faulty materials, what's likely and not likely to happen is if you go to the quarry and you say, all right, all that marble looks really good, and behind the face of it, there's a huge underground cave, and you thought you had this much marble, and what you have is this much marble around the edge of that cave. Unexpected, but there's a risk. The risk is you don't have enough materials, and where would you source alternate materials? And how likely is that to happen? We'll get to that in a new slide. And how would you respond when risks arise? We've got a few responses here. Double check the architecture. Have another architect look at it or do a load test for it. Food shortage. We can stockpile food, or at least figure out that two countries over, they've been having good weather as well, so there are alternate sources of food and labor if we want to go ransack and pillage. Here is what you folks are asking for. My gentleman in the back, I will actually introduce myself. I'm Tom, I'm from Northeastern in Chicago.
Nate, so I do this. Nate,
good to know you.
Yeah.
So what Nate and Fran were talking about, this is it. Categorize your risks by the event, the probability, and its impact to the project. And you also do other things that are less numerically situated like doing a review of the documents, so you would want to see, okay, well, what did previous pharaohs do? Just to make sure that this pharaoh isn't, you know, crazy that I want a monument bigger than and better than, although that was true, wasn't it? They all wanted bigger than and better than. So you'd have to be reasonable about what that meant. Do brainstorming using anonymous expertise. We do this in academic publishing all the time. We have anonymous review. We do it work for our projects as well. We ask for experts to weigh in on a project, and only one person on the project knows who those reviewers are, and then that one person gives our internal team the anonymous feedback. And people take anonymous feedback much better than feedback from the people they know, even if it is the people they know. Doing interviews, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats analysis. I'm going to run through these because these are familiar to most of us. Doing an assumption analysis. If we assume that we have more workers, what could we do? If we assume we have more time, what could we do? Flowchart or Ishikawa or fishbone diagrams, where we try to chart out what has to happen when. And prioritizing things for important and urgent. But to get back to what Nick and Fran were asking about, let's do P&I value on all of our risks here. P&I is probability and impact. So we have the events. Let's actually put some numbers on this. And this is your best guess. And sometimes it's an informed guess and sometimes it's not. You can be a little back of the envelope about this. Let's start down at the bottom here. We have plotting and coups and things like that. Based on what we know about ancient Egypt, how likely is a plot to sabotage our project going to be? Zero is it's never going to happen, and 100% means, well, damn, every other pharaoh's project had some cyanide pills and sabotage and backstabbing in it. What kind of percentage based on the movies you've seen?
80. I'd say
80. 80? I hear 80. Anybody want to go higher or lower here?
I was going to say higher, but then I forgot they're pharaohs, they're gods, you know. You're not going to try to stab a pharaoh in the back, I guess.
Yeah, you don't usually mic with God. Okay. So let's say this is 80%. So I'm going to put 0.80 as the probability here. Impact. If this happens, how much would it cause the project to stop or not be able to be completed? I'm going to go back to Bob here. So if there's a plot against your project, is that it has no impact at all, or it will definitely cause the project to stop? You said something insightful earlier about probability. Yeah, it might just be a setback. It might not be something, it might be something that you could actually plan against. But let's say that the impact of a plot is fairly significant. They're trying to kill your architect, they're trying to kill your project manager, they're trying to kill Dathan. So maybe this is also 80% for impact. Let's see. Worker unrest. Your workers are not happy because of their working conditions, because they're slaves, because they're not getting fed enough, because they're not clean, because you don't allow them to practice their religion. I'm just running through the Ten Commandments in my head here. And D.W. Griffith, fine, fine filmmaker, but he got a lot of the project management right in the film. So worker unrest. Probability. How likely is it to happen? Let's say that we went with the alien overlord version here and we want to do it in 5 years, so we have a lot of slaves. We've got like 100,000 people in our workforce and we've pressed them in from all different countries. So what's the probability that we're going to have some worker unrest problems in that instance?
I'd go with a one.
It's almost certain. Actually, very good guess. And what's the impact of worker unrest? Is it going to derail the project? Is it a one, or is this something that you can deal with?
It depends on the magnitude of the unrest. In genetics, we talk about penetrance and we talk about expressivity.
Absolutely.
Who's unrest and how?
And that's actually one of the reasons why when you're doing probability and impact, you wouldn't be working with such broad categories. For the purpose of what we're doing today, we're keeping at the top level, but you really do want to get down to specifics. So worker unrest of 10% of the population rising up and or refusing to work. And then 50% of the population refusing to work, 100% of the population refusing to work. If there were no Moses in the Ten Commandments movie, it probably would have been a small worker uprising, and they would have been able to just, you know, bring out the chariots and whips, and everything would have been done. But, you know, the Savior, you know, it's, come on, how often does that happen? So, worker unrest is almost a certainty, but let's just say, for the purposes of what we're doing, 10% of your workforce refusing to work. Fairly low impact on your project, because you can always get the rest of them to work, and you can always go get more workforce, which is not true in academia, but remember, 3,000 years ago, we're fine. Last one to take a look at for P&I is plagues and disasters. So natural disasters. We know that they happen. We know that there are earthquakes. We know that there are plagues, sandstorms, dust storms. I don't know how often the locusts come to town, but I don't think it's very often. But what's the probability of a plague happening during the 5 years that we're planning on this project? How low?
Say 10, just so
you can
pull suckers around.
All right, so it's a fairly low probability. And what's the impact of a natural disaster or a plague on the project?
Pretty dark.
Everything stops, yeah. So let's say that's, you know, maybe 0.9. You could get through with a little bit of the work, but maybe not a bunch. Here's where you start quantifying some of your back-of-the-envelope guesses about your project. And this is one of the things that really opened up project management for me, was being able to quantify some of my best guesses about things. Just doing P&I, and this is, if you take away nothing else from this session, this is the stuff to remember right here. Probability of impact. So 0.10 times 0.9 equals, gives you 0.09 as your P&I value. Here we have something that's absolutely certain. 1 times 0.10 equals 0.10 is your P&I value. Here's something where you've got, let's see, 0.80 times 0.80. Sorry.
0.64.
Yeah,
0.16.
0.64.
They really did give me an English degree and not a math one, so thank you. However, you're going from a scale of 0 to 1. So if something is absolutely certain to happen and it's a deal breaker, 1 times 1 is 1. So 1 is this we have to worry about the most. So for our three values here, you'll notice that worker unrest, it's almost certain to happen, but we can work around it. So it's a low P&I value. Plagues and disasters. It's almost not certain to happen, but it would be a real wrench in the works. But it's also right around that 0.1 as the P&I value. Plotting a coup, 0.64 out of 1. So where are we going to actually dig deep and try to prevent the risks? For natural disasters, your P&I index is 0.09. You know it might happen, but do you need to lose sleep over it when you're planning out your project or implementing your project? No. You might want to have a disaster plan in place. You know, 3,000 years ago, OSHA would be very happy for you. Same thing with worker unrest. If you know that you have a tried and true way to get around the problem, don't plan too much for it. But for plotting, yeah, you need the sort of the hotline to the to your project guardians or the people who can greenlight more resources or have, you know, your secret council chamber to meet and plan this out in secret. And we found a few of those chambers hidden underneath the hills outside of Cairo. So you can see, once you get your P&I values, it helps you to rank the importance of different risks in your project. By the way, this was all negative risks. You can also perform P&I for your positive risks to see where you'll get the most bang for your buck, where you want to put your efforts, where you do want to change your time frame or spend a little more money to get more effort or get more production out of your project. And I should have had this slide up when I was talking here. Here's the crocodile god of the Nile, and I'm not even going to pronounce it because it has 7 syllables in it, and I can't remember what they are. Once you have that PNI value for known risks, you prioritize them, and you deal only with the important things and urgent. You plan only for what is actually likely. So in our scenario, planning for the plotters, yeah, that's a good use of your resources and time. And then you communicate with your stakeholders. You say, you know, there could be an earthquake, there could be a sandstorm, there could be locusts, but it's not very likely. There's going to be worker unrest, but we know how to deal with it. This is the report that you give to your provost or to your overseer or to Pharaoh's sidekick or whomever. And only about those possible risk responses, and do that negative and positive review with all of your stakeholders in the project. Let me pause for a minute and see if there are questions or light bulbs or connections coming.
Just give me an example of a positive risk.
Sure. Positive risk is, to take our heads out of ancient Egypt for a moment, if you have the possibility of working with a nationally known consultant, you're setting up a brand new center for teaching and learning, as Jared is, as Bob is, and your provost wants you to have it online and ready by January of 2014. You know that there's a nationally known consultant who could help you with the planning and the setup for your new center, but that person is already working with another client and won't be ready until the summer of 2014. You might want to do your risk analysis and say, is it worth delaying the start of our project to get that resource on board? Would it make it faster or easier enough for us to be able to justify delaying it? So it's a cost in time. Or let's say you're ready to go for January 2014 and the person you want costs more than you had budgeted for. Is it worth going to your provost and saying, you know, this person costs double what we had budgeted for outside consulting resources, but look at the turnaround time that this person gave and the advantage this person gave to these other clients. Is it worth enough to spend the extra money? So those are positive risks. You take a chance to get something good. Yep.
And then the advantage of quantifying it would be the likelihood that the provost says yes, so you can pick and choose which ones you want to spend your time prepping a case for.
Absolutely. And I always share my P&I numbers with the provost. I say, here's the probability that this will happen. Here's the impact it would have on our project. And you can see by the numbers, these are the things that suggest themselves as good ways for us to spend our time and resources, either heading off a problem or, on the positive risk side, investing to get a benefit. And I don't know about your provost, but my Pharaoh, he's a numbers guy. Yeah. So you guys are starting to make good connections here. So strategies for negative risks. And you can avoid a negative risk. So could you avoid plagues and natural disasters? No, they just happen. So transfer the risk. Could you transfer the risk to someone else for a plague or a natural disaster? No, it's going to hit you. You're geographically bound. Mitigate the risk. Could you store up food ahead of time against the natural disaster? Could you build your building to a better standard of building to avoid the natural disaster? That's why the pyramids are still standing, because the alien overlords gave us the technology to make the stones fit very closely together. Or could you simply accept the risk? In this case, we have worker unrest, and that was something that we quickly found out we can accept. Okay, so maybe 10% of our workers rise up. Goodbye, 10% of workers, we'll go get more. Right? So we can accept that risk because we already know how we're going to respond to it, or we can actually do nothing about it. And for positive risk, how do you exploit it? Share that risk with someone else. In other words, for your question, was a good one for this slide now, which is, if that consultant is willing to work with you and with a two-year college that's also in your geographical area. You split the costs, that person consults on two different things in one area. You're only paying for one set of meals, one hotel room, while the consultant is on ground. How do you enhance that positive risk? Ask that expert in your case here, ask that expert to bring in another expert. Hey, do you have a friend who also does this? Could we get two for, you know, even a little bit more money and maybe even ramp up our time frame? Or, again, accept the positive risk. And what that means is, okay, we could have paid this person more, but we really don't have any more money, so we'll find somebody whom we can't afford, and we accept that maybe that'll make the time go longer, or maybe we won't be able to accomplish all of the little extra bits we wanted to do. So those are the kinds of strategies you can do for negative and positive risks. All right, back to Pharaoh. And for those of you in the back, the thought balloon says, I hope they like the sun porch I added. So what good outcomes do you want to achieve, and who in your institution can help you communicate about risks? Let's go back to ancient Egypt for a little bit. And let's think about some of our risks. So in terms of, let's say, worker unrest, who on our team would we want to be communicating with about worker unrest?
Middle managers.
Middle managers, Dathan, the Edward G. Robinson character, who's, you know, the guy with the whip and the chariot who's overseeing the actual workers. Why is that?
He would deal with it.
They know what's going on. He would deal with it.
They depend what style or the way you want to deal with worker unrest.
That's true, too. How do you want to deal with worker unrest? Do you want to squish it? Do you want to negotiate? Those kinds of things. So that has an impact on who's going to be doing the communication and what form the communication takes. Is it a whip? Is it a letter? Is it an invitation to sit down? So, very good. Let's see, Pharaoh's timeline. Pharaoh wanted it done in 5 years. It's getting close to 5 years. Or throughout the project, whom would you want to do the communicating to Pharaoh?
His wife.
Pharaoh's wife? Tell me why Pharaoh's wife. It wasn't an answer I was expecting, but I'm intrigued.
Because men always listen to their wives.
Dangerous assumption, but I'll go with it, all right. Pharaoh's timeline on your project team.
Anybody else but you.
Yeah. So the messenger is in danger of his or her life.
The person who's been leading those subversions in that person.
Hmm. Say no more.
Can you say that again?
I was trying to kill two birds with one stone. You know, okay. The person leading the subversion, except when they might blame it on you, so that really
Oh, send one of the plotters in just in case it's bad news?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is actually to take our brains out of 3,000 years ago. If it's not on the provost's timeline, one of the things that you want to do is have one single person be the responsible point of contact for the entire project, and that person reports out at a high level to upper-level stakeholders, like a provost, like a president, like a board of directors, like a board of regents. The reason to have that one single person as a point of contact is so that there is one message coming out of the project and that there are regular communications of status update. Here's what we're going to do, here's what we're doing, here's what we did, and here's how we're meeting the needs that you specify for us. So yeah, you could send Pharaoh's wife to do that, actually. And that's, you know, if you've got Pharaoh's wife on your team, leverage that relationship and be able to leverage all of those kinds of relationships. And so think about, at the various levels, who's going to communicate about the risks that are happening and what kind of information those people need in order to be able to communicate that information effectively. So talking to the provost? Yeah, you want one person who's a leader on the project team. Talking to the people who are actually doing the coding for your website? That's going to be the individual line level supervisors. And they're going to have a different level of information and different scope of information than somebody who's overseeing the whole project. Not everybody on the project needs to know everything about the project. If somebody's curious, yeah, fill them in. So, and here's the last phase here, monitoring and controlling risks. So I had to put in the so let it be written at least once in the presentation. Hold your status meetings. Actually invite the right people at the right level frequently to see how things are going in your project and talk about the risks that you're undertaking. Talk about the things that you've already thought about in terms of making sure that you're thinking ahead about risks, but also ask them, what are the risks that we're not seeing here? Or do you have information that changes any of this? And report on those trend analysis results. If you see that things are going really, really well up until the time that the sandstorm hits, then you say, we were doing really, really well, and the sandstorm hit, and we did note that we could have plagues and natural disasters, so we may need to ask you, Pharaoh, to talk to the alien overlords and find a solution for us that we didn't have before. So I love having the alien overlord card to play here because it's, you know, it's sort of like get out of jail free card. But in many cases, I mean, I've worked on projects with my own provost and my own president where we ran into a roadblock that we saw, didn't think was likely. It happened, and we said, you know, we sort of saw this coming, but we didn't think it was very likely. And the response was, well, let's see if we can find some more funding or some more resources to throw at the project to get us back on track. Or the response sometimes was, okay, we're all right with the delay. But being able to say, yeah, we saw it coming and okay, it's here, is much better than, oh God, in terms of doing some negotiation. Share a risk register and put a chain of communication together. The person at the top talks to these three people, they talk to their five people each, they talk to their five people each. And have, especially for those of us in institutions where there's a relatively flat hierarchy and everybody talks to everybody else, this can be hard to do because everybody's used to just walking into everybody else's office. But for, especially for risk communications, it's helpful to have that I told you and you tell your people this piece of it. And then information filters down so and filters back up from the detail level up to the strategic level. And that's customizing the data for the stakeholders, give them things at a level that they can consume. Pharaoh gets to see the thing with the three nice pyramids on it, but the people in the stone cutting area, they need to know it's this many cubits wide by that many cubits. And a risk register. This is just a fancy term for a list of the risks, followed by whatever data are useful for you in planning. So our risk register is this piece of paper right now. Here are some of the negative risks. We did a P&I on it, and we have that probability and impact score for each of these things. And we would probably switch these around so that we have them in most likely and most important to least likely and least impact. And we talk about creating feedback loops, opportunities for listening at all of the levels of your hierarchy. And here is the meat of what we were talking about in the title, risk conversations. When you are actually sitting down with stakeholders in your project, make sure that you are clear about the expectations for what's going to happen. So if you're going to be communicating about the risks in your project, have a separate meeting about those. Don't just make it a little thing at the end of your general conversation. Say, here, we did this risk planning. We'd like to hear your thoughts on what could help the project move faster or better, as well as what could slow the project down or even kill it. Bring the data. Having those P&I numbers makes it easy and clear for people, A, to see the rankings, and B, to disagree with them. I said, you know, how likely is this to happen? And, of course, Fran says, I'm a data person. I want to have all of these things chopped down into finer bits. And that's the conversation that we need to have if Fran is one of our stakeholders. And it's something that if, you know, if we're working at a high level, we say, oh, Fran, you know how to do this. Can you help us chop this into more discrete pieces so that we can do a better job of doing our P&I and doing the rankings? Fran becomes one of our favorite stakeholders. And let the stakeholders lead. Fran makes the suggestion, you say, yes, that's exactly what we need to do here. And if there's a way for your stakeholders to become more involved, absolutely bring them in. And
but
so
Fran doesn't want to do that. She wants you to do that.
Well, I have a team just like that. Mm-hmm.
And I'm perfectly happy to say I don't have that expertise. It sounds like you do. Can you recommend the resources that I would need in order to do that? I have no qualms about saying I don't.
Along those lines, do you find there you have to balance out the Eeyores and the Pollyannas to get your numbers right? You know, like, oh no, that we can never do that, and to, oh hey, yeah, that's fine. I mean, that's nothing.
That's one of the reasons why I like anonymous review, is once we've done the pre-mortem, once we've had that conversation about what could kill the project, and we do a positive risk analysis as well, we don't do the P&I. We take those factors and send them out to our anonymous reviewers who are skilled. We have some Eeyores, some Pollyannas, and we can handpick them. They could be people in our own institution or people external to our institution, but people who are knowledgeable about the finances, the timelines, the human resources folks. And we ask them to do the P&I anonymously. We pull it together, we do our own P&I, and we literally do it on the numbers. We take an average of all those P&I numbers And we can say, the people from finance, they fought gloom and doom in terms of how much money we're spending. The people in human resources, they fought gloom and doom because we have too many people assigned to the project, so on and so on and so on. And it does have, you're absolutely right, it does have a tendency to average out if you're selecting folks who have different kinds of outlook. And if you remember when I showed you the big project chart, we try to find someone who has expertise in all of those areas, in time, scope, impact, implementation, all of those, monitoring and controlling. We try to find anonymous reviewers in all of those areas. So excellent question at this point here. And what do we do when we're change shepherds? Ask first, but come with recommendations, just in case. And determine the group risk acceptance. How okay are your folks? How okay is Pharaoh with this project going beyond 5 years? If Pharaoh says it's got to be done in 5 years or we're cutting off Nick's head, then Nick is probably going to want to throw more money and more resources at it until it gets done in 5 years. So takeaways. And for those of you who are native Pittsburghers, you may get this one. Why does traffic always slow down in the Fort Pitt Tunnel? If you took a cab in from the airport, you noticed this. You know, the speed limit in the tunnel is 55 miles an hour. No one ever does more than 30 miles an hour in that tunnel. But what did you learn from Pharaoh that you might be able to use in your own institution? Take your brain out of 3,000 years ago and start thinking about your new center or your dean and his or her projects or those kinds of things. What are you going to take away from our session today? We've got about 7 more minutes. I wanted to have some time here at the end.
I want to try to find, read up a little bit more on different ways that this process breaks down. Communication breaks down, or when you have that one person communicating everything to the higher level, sometimes they may not have the fullest understanding or not communicating effectively, and how do you deal with that? So
the initials to look at, Doug, PMBOK, Project Management Book of Knowledge. It is everything about formal project management in one thick book. And there is an entire piece in there on communication structures and dealing with potential breakdowns. And it had, what I like about it is it has nothing to do with academia. People use this on construction sites, in hospitals, in academia. It's written at a level that you get to apply it to your specific situation rather than it being custom tailored for you. So it's a set of general principles that you can then adapt. What are the takeaways? What are you going to use?
I think, you know, we probably all sit through a lot of strategic planning retreats, at least I do, and this part too is never discussed in that scope, and it should be the part two of it once all the dreamy ideas are out there to overlay this over the ideas. That's how I would use
it. So probability and impact, being able to quantify so that you have some idea of ranking?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Thinking about all the things that could crash the work around creating the shared vision for the center, all the things that could hold that up and make it a negative process rather than a positive one. I'm thinking about what goes on this list.
And by the way, to that point, P&I is better medicine than antacids. It helps you sleep at night because you can come up with all of these nasty things that could happen to your new center or your new project. But being able to say, yeah, that's frightening, but it's not likely to happen, you can turn the burner down on that, to mix the metaphor a little bit. And that's helped me a lot to be able to focus in on the things that I actually can do something about or plan toward. Other thoughts on what you'll take away from today's session?
I think for me, being able to, as you said before, I've been doing some of this intuitively, and being able to be more methodical and explicit, I think, will help me communicate up better.
All right, fantastic. Sure. Well, thank you everybody for an engaging session. I hope that it was useful for you and a little bit of fun for you. Always happy when we get to kill people off and bring in aliens and all those other things in our minds. So I'll just end with a little bit of an offer. I do consult, and I do it for free and for pay. So please, if you'd like, come see me after the session. I'm very happy to give you my business card. Very happy to continue the conversation with you about project management or about ancient Egypt, one of those things that I never lost from when I was 12. So thank you again. You've been a wonderful audience. It's great to have all your participation. I appreciate it. Thanks.